Housing and Elections Committee. Representative Hilke has two bills up, and we're going to go to House File 1710, the second bill, because Representative Hilke has a testifier for the first one, and that testifier is not here yet. So, Representative Hilke, why don't you make your motion on House File 1710? I'm not sure whether we have a quorum. We don't. So, Representative Hilke, why don't you make your motion? And
Mr. Chair, I would move that House File 1710 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register.
Representative Hilke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Got a little shuffling to do here. Pardon me. Mr. Chair and members, House File 1710 was brought to me by the state archaeologist who I have with me this morning, Mr. Scott Anthonson. And he will run us through the bill. Basically, what the bill does is clarify the meanings of a number of key concepts and define certain activities that can be that need to be done and who the proper authorizing authorities are. There are a number of elements to the bill, and I don't pretend to understand them well enough to explain them at this point, so I will ask Mr. Anthonson to run us through the bill.
Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
My name is Scott Anthonson. I'm the state archaeologist for Minnesota, which is a department within the Department of Administration. I'm here today to talk about the amendment of the Private Cemeteries Act. There are two cemetery acts in Minnesota. One is 306, that's for public cemeteries, and 307 is for private cemeteries. 307 was pretty basic until 1976 when the Cedar Avenue Bridge went through and hit a major Indian burial ground in 1976. So the law was amended substantially in 76 and has been amended a number of times since then, basically to deal with Indian cemeteries more than anything else. And the purpose of me being here today and redrafting the law somewhat is really to codify which are the current procedures used by the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council and the state archaeologists. So we're sort of simplifying the language, we're clarifying meanings, and we're, I tell you, I read this law once a week, and I'm still confused as to what it actually means, the existing law, because it's been sort of cobbled together over the years on an older law. And I think what I'm trying to do more than anything is straighten things out. There are a total of 12,500 known burial mounds in Minnesota from earlier Indian days. If we put these all into cemeteries plus known white cemeteries, we have over 6,000 known cemeteries in the state, and a good percentage of these are unrecorded in county recorder's offices. So the law basically says that the state archaeologists shall authenticate burials that are over 50 years old and unrecorded at county recorder's offices. So I literally get a call every day from realtors or landowners asking what they could do in their property because they think they may have Indian mounds or a white cemetery of some sort that's unrecorded on their property. So the basic purpose of this law is to clarify it not only for landowners, but to clarify it for me and the Indian Affairs as to how to carry out procedures. I don't appear before committees much, so I don't know the procedures, but I did make a brief handout here that lists the duties of the various entities in the current law, what the proposed changes would subtract and add to those. So,
Mr. Athens, we'll pass those out.
Okay. And I think that will really explain everything, and I don't know the procedures that well because I say I don't appear before committees that much, but I don't suppose we're going to go item by item through the bill. And should I just leave it open for questions, or do we need further explanation?
We can do that. Yeah. Members, is there anyone else who wishes to testify first?
Mr. Chair, we do have Mr. Jones representing the Indian Affairs Council.
All right. Is that person here? Yes. Okay. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
My name is Jim Jones. I'm the Cultural Resource Director for the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council. And like Scott, I helped to enforce 307.08, the Private Cemeteries Act. When American Indian remains are identified, or American Indian burial sites are identified, under current law, the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council has say on what happens with the protection of that burial site. Preferably, the Indian Affairs Council feeling is to leave the burial mound or site in place to protect that site. In the last few years, though, that hasn't been the case. We have been dealing with accidental unearthings on private cemetery, on private properties all across the state. Minnesota Indian Affairs Council currently has legislation in place to appropriate money to purchase a burial site, because under the current law, there's a title that says efforts should be made by the state to purchase large burial grounds. The last time the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council received an appropriation from the state to purchase a burial site was in 1984. We have currently dealt with a number of 2 to 3 accidental unearthings every year under the law. And those get turned over to the Indian Affairs Council once they have been identified as American Indian. So in the last couple of years, we've dealt with 3 different sites totaling over close to 40-some remains that we've dealt with already of people that were accidentally unearthed. So we're definitely in support of amending the law, making changes so that it clarifies. We had a burial disturbance up in Little Falls, Minnesota. The county attorney could not use this law to prosecute for destruction of a gravestone for an Indian chief that was buried up there because the law was too vague. This law will help clarify and help counties, our agency, the State Archaeologist's Office, and other agencies to help clarify the roles for the Indian Affairs Council and the State Archaeologist.
All right. Members, are there any questions? Representative House.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hilty. I think I'm a co-author. I better be careful. On page 3, starting up at the top, I think at line 5, on private lands or waters, these costs are the responsibility of the landowner. Does that affect or do anything with covenants, deeds, real estate transactions? If I were to sell my home, and it's very likely my home right now could have a burial ground, would I have to have something in the deed or the sale that would protect the future buyer from an unforeseen cost?
Representative Hilty.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to defer that question to Mr. Athanson.
Mr. Athanson.
There is an existing law, and I don't have it cited. I can't remember the name for sure, but it's with the sale of property, and it basically says that if you have a residential property and are selling it, you're supposed to disclose anything that could impede anybody else's use of that property. And certainly a burial ground on your property would do that, but you'd have to know about it in order to do that. And one of the things I'm really pushing now is that when I go out and do an authentication, I copy the county recorder's office on it, and I encourage them to get it recorded, put it on the deed, because the one benefit of having a cemetery on your property is it's tax exempt, and that really hasn't been pushed into that. So when a lot of lakeshore owners end up with burials on their property, and I say, well, you can take this part off your taxes. You can't use it to build a shed on or anything, but you don't have to pay taxes on it. So I'm encouraging people to put it on the deed, but there's nothing in law right now that requires you to have it on the deed. And I am, another part of this bill I've actually put in there that landowners, you know, should be required to tell people who are buying their land, if they know there's a burial ground there, they should be explicitly required to tell someone that there's a burial ground in their land.
Mr. Chairman, I think that would be a great idea, but you did a very good job of answering the real estate portion of the question. If I want to sell my home, during this process, I discover possibility of a burial ground or one or two graves. Am I responsible for any of the research or work done on my own property, and am I also at that point in time prohibited from selling it? and what might it cost me?
Mr. Representative, I can answer the second question first. You don't really have any. You can sell the land. There's nothing against selling a cemetery, land with cemetery on it, so that's not prohibited. If you want to go through the formal authentication process, that's what my office is there for. That's what I do. So every single day I get a call. I got two yesterday. Someone wants to sell some land. Would I come up and do an authentication? Believe me, the list is getting fairly long for the spring already. And I go up and for no charge go and do the authentication and say, yes, there's burials here. Unless it gets to be really complicated, and over the last 10 years, when there's a very complicated authentication to do, like we have to do some digging to find out if it's there, and I can't do it myself, and it says that the current law says the state shall hire qualified archaeologists to do that. Over the last 10 years, the private developers have paid for that private archaeologist rather than the state has. And that's just simply because I say, I'll put you on a list, we'll get to you when we can, or do you want it done tomorrow? And if they want it done tomorrow, they have the discretion of hiring their own archaeologist to have it done. That type of payment for an authentication happens maybe once a year that a private landowner actually pays for it. In most instances, I'm able to go there, sometimes with Jim accompanying me, and we're able to say right away, yes, there's burial mounds here. We're going to draw this line on the map and say, here's where you shouldn't disturb. And at that point, the landowner knows what they can and can't do in their property, and it doesn't cost them any money at all.
Mr. Chairman, I'll have to rephrase the question. Representative Immer believes there's a Native American buried in my backyard, maybe two. He wants you to find out, it says here in this bill that I have to pay for it and I have no recourse to go after Representative Immer. He can be tough, you know, he's an attorney. Am I paying for this if someone else wants to do research?
Mr. Atkinson.
If I can't do it with my resources, then you would be obligated to pay for it. If I can't provide it free, if I'm too busy.
Well, so, Mr. Chairman, thank you for your courtesy here. I could understand if I requested it that I should pay for it. Just not real happy that Representative Emmer is causing all this trouble and I'm paying for it.
Reb Sandhaus, it's a good thing he has his own research assistant then that could give it on the side. Nice. Mr. Atkinson,
I don't know what he would expect.
You only have to have the authentication done. You don't have to have the authentication done for the sale. I mean, you can sell the land and simply notify the new landowner that there may be a burial site. Then it's up to him. If he's going to build, say, a garage there, he's the one who's going to disturb the burial. You only have to have the authentication done if you're going to disturb it. And in most cases, we're able to avoid any disturbance. So that's the only requirement, is that the law says it's a felony to willfully disturb a burial. So if you have a hint, if you've been told by the previous landowner that there may be a burial there, I think you're under the obligation to find out if there is. And that's at the point you call my office and say, I want to build a garage. What should I do? And I said, let me come out there and see if anything's there. And at that point, I'll say to you, and 99% of the time we say there's no problem or there is a problem, and then 1% of the time we say, I think we need additional help here. I think you should hire an archaeologist to find out if there really is one by doing some digging. That's rare.
Okay. Any other questions? All right. Any other individuals wish to testify on the bill? Seeing none, then Representative Hilty renews his motion that 17...
Mr. Chair, can we move to amend this bill?
Representative Emmer, we could.
I would like to move an amendment. I'd like to delete
Emmer
on line 3.5 after the word waters. I'd like to delete the remainder of that new language through line 3.8.
Okay, Representative Emmer, specifically now you're on page 3.
Yes, sir.
And you wish to delete which lines?
Starting on 3.5 after the word waters.
All right.
Through the end of that line, and the rest of the new language through line 3.8.
All right. Mr. Shepard? Do you have that amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I think let's delete that entire sentence beginning on 3.5.
Members, everyone have the amendment? And Representative Hilty, you want to respond to... Mr. Atkinson.
Right now, the way it works is, and this is happens once or twice a summer, those rare instances, where a private landowner, usually it's a big developer, wants to develop some condominiums, or just the one just happened a couple of years ago in Bloomington where they wanted to build a $65 million building on a piece of property that had some suspected graves on it. That developer ended up paying because he wanted to build his big $65 million building, and he didn't want for me to put it on my list of, well, I'll get to it in three summers because I'm so packed now I can't get to it until then. So, you know, I don't think that by changing this it would change that the landowner has the discretion of paying for it on their own. I mean, if he wants to hire a private archaeologist and to give me information, I still do the authentication, but it's up to them if they want to hire someone to do it. And so I don't think that would cause a major problem, that amendment, because it still would be discretionary on the part of the landowner. If they wanted to hire an archaeologist, they could, to help me out so it'd get done sooner.
Mr. Chair, that's fine. It just got me. I felt threatened by Representative Howes, so I thought it was important that this language have a little bit more thought before it actually goes into a final product. So, no, that's fine. If
Representative, when Representative Howes checks in, he's here.
It sounds like everybody's in agreement on my amendment.
So, any further discussion on the Emmer amendment? And all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Any further discussion on the bill? Mr. Athanson.
I met with the Minnesota Historical Society yesterday, and they recommended the changing of one or two words in there. Should I tell you what those are right now, or should we?
Yes, you should.
Okay.
And now would be a very good time.
And as I say, what they are is basically. I got the. I got to find the right line number because I wrote it on my draft, not on yours. Here, it's in the new subdivision 9. Let's see, subdivision. Construction and Development Plan Review. In line 424,
all right.
It reads, and prior to any construction within the burial area, the society recommended that we change the word construction to disturbance, because sometimes people go in and do like tree grubbing prior to doing the actual construction, and that can disturb a burial. So substituting the word disturbance for construction was recommended by the historical.
Right. So, Mr. Athanson, on line 4.24, after any, we want to delete the word construction and insert the word disturbance. That's the first change.
Yes.
And, Mr. Shepherd, you've got that?
Yes, sure.
All right. Then the next one.
The other one would be under the definition section. It would be 6.4. And this is another recommendation by the Historical Society. They suggested that it's not only sometimes tombstones. This mark comes out of, there's an example, in 306 right now, abandoned cemeteries are defined as marked cemeteries in 306. And so that's why I put the definition there. And it says, means a burial area that has recognizable tombstone. Sometimes the society says they're not actual tombstones or other kinds of markers that are there. So they suggested wording that has a recognizable tombstone and then carried in, or obvious grave marker.
So after, on line 6.4, after the word tombstone, or obvious grave marker?
Yes.
And then it would read in place or a legible sign?
Yes.
Mr. Shepherd?
Mr. Chair, that
works. Are there any other changes?
Yep.
Jim might have something.
Okay, Mr. Jones, you have one?
Yeah. Going back to subdivision 4. Line number 2.28.
2.28. All right.
Strike contract archaeologist to professional and add professional archaeologist.
Wait a second. I'm on line 2.28, and you want to strike
contract?
All right. And just add the word professional?
Yes. Next part, qualified...
Hold it. Okay. Let's just wait for 1 second. Mr. Shepard? So it would read the professional archaeologist? Is that
yes.
the way you wish it to read? And then what was the other?
And add qualified in front of anthropologist. So that it's consistent with the previous wording in the first part of the paragraph.
So insert the word qualified in front of anthropologist.
Correct.
All right. Mr. Shepard?
Mr. Chair, that makes sense, and I do have all of these written down for Ms. Anderson. All right. I'll give them to her in a minute.
All right. Are there any other changes we need to make? Representative Hilty or Mr. Anderson or the Historical Society? Right. Representative Hilty, you want to move those changes?
I will make that motion, Mr. Chair.
All right. Representative Hilty moves those deletions and changes to the bill. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Any further discussion on this bill? No? Then Representative Hilty renews his motion that House File 1710, as amended, be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Registry. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Bill's passed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Representative Hilty, you have House File 1051. Are you ready for...
I believe we are, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hilty.
Mr. Chair, members, House File 1051 basically makes some reorganization to the Indian Affairs Council, changing some of the membership, but also correcting and clarifying much of the language in the current statute. I do have an amendment, which we can get to in a minute, that's just some clarifying language, and I actually have an amendment to the amendment. But I think before we get to that, we'll ask Mr. Small, who was instrumental
Representative
in drafting
Hilty, have you moved the bill yet?
I don't believe I have, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I would move that House File 1051 be recommended to pass and be referred to the General Register.
All right. That motion is before us. Then Representative Hilty.
Mr. Chair, I would like to have Mr. Andrew Small, who, as I was saying, was instrumental in drafting the new language to just walk us through the bill and the rationale for the changes.
All right. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Andrew Small. I'm with Blue Dog Paulson and Small. We work with Indian tribes throughout the state. And I was asked by the Indian Affairs Council to try to put into a bill structure their ongoing discussions over the past several years to restructure the council to actually make it somewhat more effective, make it more than a formal visitation between tribal leaders and commissioners and other people within the legislature and the administration. So what this bill does is substitutes the actual membership of the voting membership of the council and removes the tribal leaders themselves and substitutes their designated appointees to be able to meet with the commissioners who have been attending the meetings and any other persons that the legislature or the governor deem appropriate to attend these meetings. The purpose is to have actual functional discussions that look at problem solving so that there can be resolution to issues that go on all the time and make recommendations for resolutions that always occur between the state and tribes, and make a recommendation to the elected leadership of the legislature, to the governor, and the elected tribal leaders for an annual summit to sit down and determine whether or not actual agreement can be reached for on the recommended resolutions. So that's really the thrust of this. The first part of the bill obviously changes the fairly long section on membership, but what it does is, as I said, make the appointment by tribal leaders the actual voting members of the council. And as one commissioner, there's been a lot of communication recently with the Commissioner of Veterans Affairs on issues of interest among tribes in the state, and so it's suggested that with all of these commissioners within the department, within the executive, that the department of the Commissioner of Veterans Affairs be added to that. Most of what you see here is unchanged, except in the proper identification of tribes or tribal governments and distinguishing between urban Indian communities and tribal sovereign governments. This bill was originally drafted in 1963, and it had a lot of good intent, but it didn't really identify the parties to the exacting standards that it probably should have. So throughout here, you'll see tribal sovereign nations and urban Indian communities rather than the Indian community in the state of Minnesota. No such thing exists. So that clarification has also been offered throughout, and those are essentially sections, subdivisions 6 and 7, where those occur. Two structural changes are in subdivision 2 and subdivision 8, and that's in the removal of a statewide election, which I haven't gotten to meet with Mr. Ritchie, but no one remembers a statewide election having been held for at-large members to the council for quite some time. And we already have, throughout this time, an advisory board on urban Indian affairs, and so it was a little bit redundant, and the tribal leaders thought that it would be better to get rid of a potentially cumbersome process that's really not going on, and have the advisory board, and it's changed from council to board in Section 8, to have the urban advisory board making those recommendations to the council. So they removed the subdivision 2. That's essentially the thrust of the legislation, Mr. Chairman. And I think Representative Hilty has some corrections that he'd like to make to what's been presented.
Representative Hilty, the A2 amendment, do you want to move that at this time?
I do, Mr. Chair. I have to make a slight change on line 1.3. To bring the language here into consistency with the terms in the rest of the bill, what we want to do is to strike groups and substitute sovereign nations. So it would be one member of each of the following tribal sovereign nations, which is the language that appears in the rest of the bill.
All right. Representative Hilty, Mr. Shepard, Representative Hilty is going to incorporate on line 1.3, delete groups and insert sovereign nations. Does that work?
Yes.
All right. So, Representative Hilty, we will incorporate that into the amendment.
As I said earlier, Mr. Chair, what the amendment does really is just clarify. When we were reading over the original language, there was some question about who was being included or not in the voting group, and this just makes clear who is in that group. If members need further explanation, Mr. Shepard, who was patient with me last evening in working through some of these questions, can explain it probably better than I.
Mr. Shepard, do you want to?
Mr. Chair, if you would like, I can walk through technically what these changes are in the amendment, if you'd like me to.
Why don't we let Mr. Shepard do that, and then we know what has been changed in the bill. So before we go to questions, let's let Mr. Shepard. All right.
Mr. Chair, before we do that, there is another amendment that I think that you have.
Another change in this one?
No, not to this amendment. There's another.
Why don't we? Well, let's adopt this one first.
To be distributed while he's doing
it. Right. And then let's distribute the second amendment. Mr. Shepard, walk us through this one, and while the second amendment's being distributed. And
Mr. Chair, members, as Representative Hilty indicated, the change on page 1, line 2 and 3 of the amendment just clarifies. Is basically clarifying the grammar of that sentence to clarify that one member of each of the following tribal sovereign nations would be a member of the council. And then the changes on page 1, line 5, 6, and 7 are basically breaking this long list down into clauses so that it's easier to refer to. And then the change on page 1, lines 8, and 9 of the amendment, which is page 3, line 4 of the bill, clarifies something that was not clear in the original version, which is that only if the members of the council that are designated under clause 1, which would be the people that are on page 2, lines 3 to 13 of the bill, only those members are voting members. So it clarifies that the legislators, the commissioners of state agencies are not voting members, which wasn't really clear in the original bill. And then on the last two lines of the amendment clarify that only those same tribal members are going to get compensation for, as is the case under current law, for serving on this council. The other folks would not.
All right. Representative Hilty, any further discussion to the A2 amendment? Representative Emmer.
Mr. Chair, perhaps Mr. Shepard could make it clear so folks understand this is not just clarifying language. There is a significant difference between tribal group and the term sovereign nation. More importantly, Mr. Shepard, isn't it true there's a significant difference between the term sovereign and sovereign nation?
Mr. Shepard?
Mr. Chair, members, and perhaps I should defer that to one or more of the witnesses because I don't think I have a very good answer on that one.
Mr. Small, you want to respond to that?
Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to. I'm not sure where the word group came from. Was that part of your amendment?
Yes.
Okay. The law clearly recognizes that Indian tribes are not associations, and the language in the Supreme Court cases says they're not mere associations, and they're not groups. They are tribal sovereigns. And the language of art is typically tribal sovereign nations. And I guess that we may have a different understanding of what that might represent, and it may appear that that may be elevating tribal sovereigns to something that is not part of our general sensibilities, if you will. But the fact of the matter is that tribes are tribal sovereigns, and if they refer to themselves as nations, it appears that the legislature would be simply following in their government-to-government relationship with tribes, recognizing that that's how they refer to themselves.
Mr. Chair, sir, I do respect the fact that from your point of view, considering who you represent, the fact that the tribal sovereigns might refer to themselves as tribal sovereign nations is just something that might be important to your sensibilities, but the cases, Mr. Chairman, that address this specifically refer to tribal sovereigns because they are not nations, with all due respect, within the borders of the state of Minnesota or any other state. And I think in order to be consistent with the law and not to try and create more confusion or any confusion, because I don't believe there is any now, If the author would be willing, I do respect the fact that he wants to change it from tribal groups, to keep it as it is in the law, which is a tribal sovereign as opposed to a tribal nation. And frankly, there are some folks here, I'm sure, who will sit and say, well, you're just splitting hairs. You know, words mean things. They don't just appeal to our sensibilities. They mean things. And tribal sovereign nation is not the correct legal term. Tribal sovereign would be more appropriate. Tribal groups would be fine. I'm asking if the author would be interested in amending his proposed language to tribal sovereign.
Representative Hilke, you've got another individual that's come up to the table. Do you want to have either Mr. Small or... who wishes to respond to that? Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself.
I'm the chairman and members of the committee. My name is George Dogley, Jr., and I'm the chairman of the Village Lake Band of Ojibwe. I'm also the secretary.
Excuse me one second. Can you give us your name again, please? It was George. Just repeat your name, please.
George Dogley, Jr.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I'm military, left me with very little hearing.
Okay, proceed.
Thank you. At this point in time, I'm not in a position to make a decision on that issue. I must confer with Chairman Lisi and other members of the Indian Affairs Council on that particular issue.
All right. President Hilke, do you wish to leave it as tribal sovereign nation?
That would be my preference, Mr. Chair.
All right.
I'm willing to continue the discussion about this, and if it turns out that the language can be changed, needs to be changed, I'm willing to take that up at a later time, but I don't think that we'd be prepared to do that at this time.
All right. Representative Broad, did you have a question on the amendment?
Go right ahead.
Our representative member?
I would, at this point, I think this is a significant issue, whether the chairman or the other members of the committee agree with me. I think it's important enough that I would move to put this on the table. It's not debatable, but the reason, Mr. Chairman, not to frustrate the committee, is to allow the witness to speak to whomever he needs in order to get this taken care of.
Representative, the motion before us is the A2 amendment.
Put it on the table as a higher motion.
All right, so Representative, you're moving to table the bill. That's what you're doing. All right. The motion is to table the bill. It's not a debatable motion, so all those in favor of tabling the bill signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, nay.
No.
Motion does not prevail. So we are back to the amendment.
On the A2, if we're going to do that, I'd ask for a roll call.
All right. Roll call has been requested on the A2 amendment. Any further discussion on the A2 amendment? Seeing no further discussion, the clerk will take the roll. The chair votes aye on the A2 amendment.
Representative Anderson? Aye. Representative Broad?
No.
Representative Emmer?
No.
Representative Filkey?
Aye.
Representative Howes?
Aye.
Representative Kahn?
Aye.
Representative Kalin?
Aye.
Representative Morgan? Representative Nelson?
Aye.
Representative Olson? Representative Peterson?
Aye.
Representative Coffey?
Aye.
Representative Simon?
Aye.
Representative Winkler?
Aye.
Representative Rothschild?
No.
Seeing that there are 11 ayes and 3 nays, the A2 amendment is adopted. And the bill... Oh, wait. Do we have one more amendment? We have the A1 amendment, Representative Hilke. So, Representative Hilke, do you wish to move the A1 amendment?
Well, I think I do, Mr. Chair, but I don't have a copy of it yet.
Can we get a copy of the A1?
Right. Representative Hilty, would you move the amendment for us, and then Mr. Shepard has a technical change.
Yes, I would move the adoption of the A1 amendment.
All right. Mr. Shepard.
Mr. Chair, members, the previous amendment that the committee adopted inserted numbered clauses in front of all these. So on this amendment, line 3, before the word 3, there should be inserted in parentheses the number 4.
All right, members, everybody have that. And Representative Hilty will incorporate that into his amendment. Representative Hilty, to the amendment.
Mr. Chair, members, what this amendment does is add additional legislative members to the council appointed in the typical way in which such appointments are made. The bill before us changes the membership, which has been 3 members from each of the legislative bodies, and particularly since those appointments have been made, actually at the request of the speaker. I felt that we should restore the number to what it has traditionally been, which is what this amendment would do.
Any discussion to the A1 amendment? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Hilty, any further discussion to House File 1051? Representative Emmer?
Yes. Representative Hilty, could you tell me on page 3, subdivision 3, it appears that we are now going to start giving this the non-legislative members of this group per diem. Is that? Did I read that correct?
Representative Hilty.
Mr. Chair, members, this is a discussion that I had with Mr. Shepard yesterday to clarify who was getting per diem and who was not, and I would defer the question to Mr. Shepard.
Mr. Shepard?
Mr. Chair and members, Representative Emmer, the old reference under Section 15.059 did provide for the non-legislative members to get $55 a day per diem and expense reimbursement, and the new language would be the same. The amendment that the committee adopted earlier, the A2 amendment, did make a change here so that the only members who would get this per diem are those who are appointed in under Clause 1, which is the people listed on page 2, lines 3 through 13. So those people, it's my understanding, do get per diem under the current law. They would continue to get per diem under this bill if it were enacted.
Representative Member.
Mr. Chair, so Mr. Shepard, and I think you just said this, I need to ask it, so it doesn't change anything.
Mr. Chair, Representative Member, no. I think the reference has changed because the 15.059 is a statute that generally applies to groups that are purely advisory. And I think the statute provides that this group is not purely advisory, and therefore they're changing the reference to refer to boards that aren't purely advisory, but they'll get the same amount.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Emmer.
Mr. Shepard, so are we changing the nature of this board then?
Mr. Shepard.
Mr. Chair and Representative Emmer, not by this amendment. I think Representative Hilty and the others can comment on whether the rest of the legislation, what it does to the duties on the rest of the board, but by changing this reference, it does not change, this reference does not by itself change the nature of the board. If you'll notice the sentence on immediately after the reference to Section 15.0575, it currently states that because the council performs functions that are not purely advisory,
right.
And so that I think is probably what was motivating the people who drafted this.
Thank you.
Representative Bryant, did you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think 3 quick questions. One is, what is the, Representative Hilty, what is the actual size of the board? Because I'm reading I read 11 somewhere, but I'm reading through all the people who are involved, and it seems rather large.
Representative Hilke or Mr. Small? Mr. Small, you want to?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The voting membership of the board has always been 11 representatives in each of the tribes, and participants at the table have been people from the Department of Corrections, some commissioners, whoever it happens to be that has issues to come forward. So what this tried to do was make it clear that there is going to be a constructive dialogue, so people that could take part in this definitely would be commissioners and their counterparts in the tribe, but the actual voting membership of the board would be the council. The governor would still make his or her appointments, and the House and Senate leadership would make their appointments, but nothing would really change. So the actual number of the board is a little bit amorphous because people come with issues to discuss, but it doesn't change the structure of the board.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Mr. Small. Maybe it's appropriate to you to ask you the next question. Then, on page 3, subdivision 5, I'm just trying to find out what the effect of the new language is that states that at the direction of the tribal leaders, the staff will be hired. I'm wondering why the change and what the effect of that change is.
Mr. Small,
thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative. That duty or that responsibility rested with the tribal leaders as the members of the council throughout the time that this statute has been in place. And this was a suggestion by the tribal leadership to demonstrate some responsibility to the state regarding the regulation of these kinds of actions. So rather than their appointees having carte blanche to make those decisions, they would still oversee that kind of action.
Mr. Chairman, and Mr. Small, thank you for that explanation. It just seems to me that the people on the council, whether it's the elect or the tribal leaders or their appointed, the person that they want representing them, it seems like the authority to hire should come from the council, not from those same people, but at the same time, it should come through the council as a matter of course. But maybe my third question is on the last page, on the rulemaking piece, it says rules adopted before July 1st, 2001 may continue in effect until amended or repealed by law. Why is that necessary? And if I read that correctly, that means everything that's happened between 2001 and now is up in the air or gone.
Mr. Small?
Yes, I have to plead ignorance, which is sometimes difficult for me, Mr. Chairman. But this went through the revisor's office to check on everything that needed to be changed. And the revisor's office made the recommendation that this subsection 10 could stand as it was. So beyond that...
Well, this is current law, so yes. You're not changing anything in the section. I don't know if that answers Representative Broad's question, but... It
doesn't, Mr. Chairman. Can Mr. Shepard maybe help me understand that a little bit? It just seems like there's a gap there.
Mr. Chairman, members, I don't have specific knowledge of what has occurred under the current law. As I'm reading it here, it strikes me that likely what happened is that in 2001, this was amended to provide that the council doesn't have any authority to adopt any further rules, but they must have had something in place then that the legislature wanted to keep in place, but I apologize, I don't know what that was.
Okay.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'll just do some research and try to figure that out. It just seems that you're excluding a significant portion of time, and I'm just wondering what happened in that time, so that's for another day.
All right. Any further discussion to House File 1051 as amended? Representative Emmer.
One question, Mr. Chairman, and to whoever can answer it that's up at the table. On page 4, at line 4.18, I'm interested to know what's included in non-tribal Indian organizations.
Mr. Small, can you respond to that? 4.18, non-tribal Indian organizations.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Representative, The general reference was made rather than referring to all the different agencies that that exist that have relationships or communication with the state. There are healthcare entities, there are housing entities, there are child development entities. There are a lot of different organizations that exist to help the general Indian population. And rather than listing all of those, it would just be those organizations that have that relationship.
Okay. And then, member, if you'll just drop down a few lines to 4.26. It seems to, or it looks to me like there's a significant change in what you're doing. It says assist in providing resources. Assist in providing resources, and now you've changed it to say assist in ensuring the provision of resources. Why was that change necessary?
Mr. Small.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Representative, the council, the way this was drafted, the council couldn't ever legally assist in providing services. That action of the provision of services is or the delivery of services is something that the state or the agencies or whoever are doing it would have taken on. And so ensuring the provision of is essentially helping the process rather than actually doing the delivery of the services.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Emmer.
I'll save it for another day.
All right, Representative Bolton.
Well, Chair, members, I do share some of your concerns, Representative Emmer, but are we on the amendment? Because the questions being asked aren't on the amendment.
Representative, no, we run the bill as amended.
All right.
The amendments have been adopted.
They have. All right.
Any further discussion?
I'd like a roll call on the final vote. On the
roll call has been requested. Seeing no further discussion.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I was looking at what was amended while I was called out, and the question I had is whether or not sovereign tribal groups, whether or not that's defined in current law.
Representative Olson, we've had that discussion while you were out.
I inquired to see if that question in particular was answered, and I understand that it was answered.
Well, Representative Olson, I believe what we have is an ongoing discussion on that issue, and the amendment was adopted with it in. Do you have a specific question about
My specific question is whether or not that is defining current law.
Mr. Small, can you respond to that?
Sure, Chairman. Thank you. Representative, you had used the term tribal sovereign group. there's no such thing in the law. There are references in the law to tribal sovereign nations, and as Representative Emmer has indicated, there are references to tribal sovereigns. In the law, there's no such thing as a sovereign group. The federal law has indicated very clearly that they're Indian tribes, sovereign Indian tribes. They're not groups. They're not associations, that kind of thing. So there is nothing that says group. The words that were chosen here were words that the tribes refer to themselves as tribal sovereign nations.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate that clarification. And that's, I believe, a very good reason for the roll call, because I think it's something vitally important to be defined. And my question was answered that it's not defined. Thank you.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will take the roll. Representative Hilty renews his motion that House File 1051 be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Registry. The chair votes aye. I'm sorry, what?
As amended.
As amended. I'm sorry, as amended. The chair votes aye.
Representative Anderson?
No.
Representative Broad?
No.
Representative Emmer?
No.
Representative Hilty?
Aye.
Representative Collins? Representative Khan?
Aye.
Representative Keelan?
Aye.
Representative Nelson?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
No.
Representative Peterson?
Aye.
Representative Coffey?
Aye.
Representative Simon?
Aye.
Representative Winthrop? Representative Walsh Rocker?
No.
The motion prevails with a vote of 8-5. House File 1051 is amended, will be sent to the General Register. Next on the agenda is Representative Simon, House File 1546. Before we start on Representative Simon's bill, if a page would come up here, we may need to run off some more roll call sheets. We thought we'd have enough for the entire session, and apparently we're running out of roll call sheets. So if the page could run off probably about 20 more.
Mr. Chair?
Isn't that a list that means executive roll call?
Representative Kahn, as I've said before, we try to be accommodating.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Olson.
Does that mean we have 19 amendments in one bill?
Representative Olson, we have as many as it takes. Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm here to bring forward House File 1546, which is the automatic voter registration bill. Before I do that, Mr. Chair, how would you like to handle the opposite?
Well, Representative Simon, why don't we put the bill before us first? So let's get the motion before us. Where do you want this bill to go?
Mr. Chair, I think this needs to go to the finance.
So Representative Simon moves that House File 1546 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Finance Committee. All right, bills before us. Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I said, this 1546 is the automatic voter registration bill. There is an author's amendment, however, the Chair would like to handle that.
Let's handle that amendment right now, if we could. Is that the A1 amendment, Representative Simon?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
All right. Representative Simon, do you want to move the A1 amendment?
I will.
Representative Simon moves the A1 amendment. And Representative Simon, what is in the amendment?
Well, if I could, Mr. Chair, once we adopt it, maybe talk about it as a whole.
All right. So Representative Simon moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is the automatic registration bill, and I think the thing that members should know about this, first of all, is this isn't that big of a change. If you look at the handouts that you should have received by now, I hope they're being handed out right now.
Representative Simon, we've got several. There's Department of Public Safety and a Minnesota driver's license form. So.
Okay. Those are the ones I'm referring to. If you look, members, at the Minnesota driver's license card application form, this is a copy, obviously, of the current sheet. In the lower right-hand corner, there's an option for the person, for the citizen, to opt in. That is, to check a box saying that they wish, by executing this document, to be registered to vote. This bill, at its core, basically reverses the presumption. So now it's an opt-out rather than opt-in. The person is presumptively deemed to want to be registered unless they check the box, where here it's an opt-in. If they wish to be registered, they check the box. At the core of this bill, that's what the bill does. And I think that's the most important part about it. As you'll hear from Secretary of State Ritchie and from Mr. Manske here, who will introduce themselves in a moment, this is something that the counties like. It makes their life simpler. It saves them money. It will save the state money. And it actually enhances and improves ballot security in a number of ways, which we'll get into in a minute. So to walk you through the bill and explain why it's necessary and why it's a good idea, I'd like to first turn it over to our Secretary of State, Mark Ritchie.
Mr. Secretary, welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Mark Ritchie. I'm Secretary of State. I want to walk through the bill kind of top to bottom, but I want to say one word in background. This came to us from the county auditors and the local election officials who pointed out the very high costs that they were facing and also the stress on the system from some of the current ways that we are operating, pointing out that we have a very high number of registrations that have to be entered into the statewide voter registration system after each election, especially presidential, normally over 500,000. And that a number of those registration changes or those registrations that were new could be addressed through some automatic system. This bill actually addresses two of those opportunities. One of them, which is in Section 2, is the use of the U.S. Postal Service's system for forwarding addresses or change of address. And the third section looks at the automatic voter registration through the cooperation with the Department of Public Safety and with our state judicial system. The first section of the bill simply clarifies the use of the postcard or notification that we use. It's a non-forwardable card that we use to double-check and make sure that the registration is proper. So let me start actually with Section 2, which is the section where we would make use of the U.S. Postal Service and vendors that they work with to automatically update voter registrations where a citizen who was registered to vote, who went in and changed their address, that notice would come to us. We would double check to see if they were in the system or not. If they were, we would update their address and we would send them a notice to them at their new updated address stating that we had received word from the Postal Service or vendor that they had moved, they had changed their address. We would ask them to verify again that they were wanting their voter registration to be updated to that address, and if not, to let us know within 21 days, and that they would clarify that all the information stated was proper. And we would use that system to automatically update. If they were moved out of state, we would send them a notification that said you are going to be removed from the voter registration rolls unless you indicate otherwise that it's a temporary move or to some other reason you're maintaining your residency. So that section, we believe, could eliminate a very large number of the Election Day registrations, which are now simply a change of address, and it would allow for a much cleaner voters list. Many of us who run for office are quite familiar with how hard it has been to keep addresses current. So we think this electronic system of using existing information will cut down greatly on both Election Day registration and give us a much cleaner and a more secure voter list at the end of the day. Section 3 is the change, as was described by Representative Simon, from our current system. We've been working closely with the Judiciary and Department of Public Safety for quite a while on transferring information electronically of those citizens who've asked to be registered through the voter driver's license system. Under this proposal, the driver's license application would request and would obtain the age and the citizenship status, which are the important things that we rely on Department of Public Safety for right now. Unless somebody indicated by marking a box that, no, I do not want to be registered, those who did meet those standards of age and citizenship, names would be electronically transmitted to the Office of Secretary of State. We would double-check those against information sent to us electronically by the judiciary, because there are two other things we must check. One is current felony status. Are they a felon who has not yet completed all terms, parole or probation? And second, the court sometimes takes away voting rights for guardianship purposes or incompetence purposes. If a citizen met all four of those criteria, the age, the citizenship, felony status, and guardianship status, then we would transmit the information to the county of residence. The county would send out the letter or the note to the citizen, to the person who is being registered, saying, you are going to be registered at this address. Is that address correct? Do you meet the four standards? And if you do not want to be registered, again, it's another option to say, no, I don't care to be registered. That system, we believe, could save in total about $1 million a year in the election cycle. It would both reduce post-election data entry, the errors that occur in the cost, but also would reduce the number of poll workers that were actually necessary and needed on election day as well. And I would like to ask my colleague, Joe Mansky, who's head of elections here in Ramsey County, to address the kind of savings and the kind of improvements in the system that the county auditors saw when they brought this proposal to our office.
Mr. Mansky, welcome to the committee, and identify yourself for the
record. Mr. Chairman, Joe Mansky from Ramsey County, and I'm here again speaking for the county auditors today, and I will try to keep this as short as possible. When you fill out one of these voter registration cards, it takes our staff about a minute and a half to enter it into the statewide voter registration system. If you check the box on the driver's license application and you get the file transfer from the Department of Public Safety, it takes us 30 seconds to do this. We save a minute on every transaction by getting the file transfer rather than having you fill out a card. At least that's the rate that we pay our staff. It's about 22 cents per card. And if you just kind of do the arithmetic there, you can see that at least in our office, we would save $20,000 to $25,000 every year just by going away from a lot of these and doing more of these. My other interest in this, Mr. Chairman, since I also conduct state polls elections, which means I'm responsible for appointing 1,400 election judges, which I will do next year. If I could just reduce the number of judges by one judge per precinct by having less election day registration, I will save $14,000 every time I do that. And if you authorize this activity, we'll reduce the judges by more than one. More likely, the way I'm looking at it right now and looking at this very conservatively, we're looking at probably three judges in a biennium, which amounts to about $40,000 to $45,000 every biennium just in the city of St. Paul.
Any further discussion to either Secretary of State or Mr. Mansky? Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Secretary of State Ritchie, thank you very much for being here. I was listening to you very closely on politics the other day, and you did a very nice job. But some of the things you said were very intriguing to me. One thing that you mentioned in regards to the business services section that of the Secretary of State's office is that you're seeing a lot of shell corporations come in, and you're working with Senator Coleman on solving some of those problems. One of the things that I think I heard you say was this is occurring because we have a very open, transparent, and easy system, and I'm wondering if you could maybe comment about that a little bit, and then I'll get to where I'm going with the question.
Mr. Secretary. Mr. Chairman, Representative Brutt, in my meeting with Senator Coleman in his office in Washington, he went through a long list of things that he felt like were changes in federal law that would then prescribe procedures at the state level that would then change how our office was operating based on federal law. So I think you would have to consult with federal lawmakers to actually have answers to that question.
Sure. Representative Brutt. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Secretary Ritchie, I think part of the reason I was even bringing that up is I think it's probably a good idea to make some changes in that direction. But one of the things I think I heard you said, I was driving, but I was writing, and I pulled over, actually, because you were very interesting. But I think you said it made us a target of shell corporations and things for the purposes of money laundering and things like that, which we don't want. But you had linked it to the openness and transparency of the way that our system currently works. And I'm wondering, why does that not hold true for elections? If it holds true for the creation of these shell corporations on the business services side of the Secretary of State's office, why does that argument not hold true on the election side?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Brown, I feel very confident that our Department of Public Safety has the capacity to enforce law, understand law, interpret law. This is not a competence that I yet have in our U.S. Congress.
Okay, Representative Black, can we focus on the bill before us?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Under a slight time crunch here.
Sure, Mr. Chair, thank you very much. The other thing I was
Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Secretary Ritchie, one thing you had said very clearly is that we do not have election fraud in Minnesota. And so my question to you in regards to this bill is, so why make changes? I mean, if we're doing great, why are we moving in a direction of using an Internet-based system, which is, I think everybody knows, and I think the business services, that's the reason I brought it up, is that your discussion of the business services section links back in. I mean, why would we go to an Internet-based automatic system that is ripe for fraud? There's a lot of very creative people out there, not necessarily always in this room, and I'm wondering why we would move away from the paper trail that we've been trying to create over the past number of years. Representative Hilty has worked very hard to make sure that we have paper trails in our elections, and that's a concern of mine.
Mr. Secretary, Mr. Chairman, Representative Broad, I absolutely share your concern that we have paper trails in our elections, and of course, we must have paper trails in our driver's licenses as well. But the purpose of this bill is about saving time and money and making our elections more secure. And perhaps my colleague, Mr. Mancy, could address the question about, is $1 million important to the counties and local governments? Perhaps that's my question. Mr. Mancy.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Broad, if Representative Simon will give me a prop that I can wave around here. We still will have a paper trail because when you go in to get a new driver's license because the 4 years are up, you move, you change your name, whatever the deal is, you're still going to fill out a form. You're still going to sign it. You're still going to attest that everything on here is true. This document will remain in the custody of the Department of Public Safety, but it will be available to us. They scan it and archive it. So, from our standpoint, and I'm not here to speak for the county attorneys, but obviously we work closely with them, if we have a question about someone's application, we can go back and retrieve this document because we do have it. And I wouldn't be sitting here today advocating the system if we did not have this paper trail.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Mansky, thank you very much. One of the things that Representative Simon said, and with all due respect, you said this is a small change, but I really do think, Mr. Chairman and members, I do think this is a very large change. It's a change in the burden. If I read the bill correctly, the Secretary of State's office actually has to... Secretary of State's office, I must have the wrong... The Secretary of State actually on lines 2.24, I mean, the Secretary of State has a lot of burdens in this bill that they didn't have before, it appears to me. I mean, it seems like rather than having the burden on the person to say, I am eligible, I am a citizen, I am registered, now the Secretary of State's office will have to essentially prove those things, if I read the bill correctly. So it seems like a pretty significant switch in regards to the burden and the liability on the Secretary of State's office.
Mr. Secretary, you want to respond?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Broad, we've gone through very carefully analyzing this. We feel like this will save our office a great deal of time and money, but, of course, the greatest savings will be at the city and county level because that's who actually has the burden of post-election data entry and providing the election judge. Mm-hmm. Mr. Mansky.
And Mr. Chairman, Representative Broad, again, if you want to look at this, and again, I'm hoping, since I'm not, and I say this with respect to my friends from the Department of Public Safety, I'm not a real fan of this form. I hope we can come up with a better application. But again, when you sign this right now, and this will be the case in the future as well, you are not only signing for all the driver's license aspects of this form, but you're also stating the same oath that we have on our voter registration card. So we're getting the same information from the voter registration card on this single form. And, talking about shifting the burdens, and I would like to, Mr. Chairman, direct this comment to Representative Kahn. One burden I would like to shift to the state is have the state pay for the postcards that we mail out to you when you do fill out one of these forms. So, Representative Kahn, if you have a few dollars in your pocket, I would be happy to shift this burden to you.
Mr. Mansky, we would hope that that would happen. But from the amount of money that's being saved from your earlier
comments. Mr. Chairman, point well taken.
Mr. Chairman, and Mr. Mansky, you're a great advocate for your folks, so good job on that. But well, when I read the amendment that was put on, Mr. Chairman, on lines 1.13, and this was what I was fumbling for earlier, it says that the Secretary of State shall determine whether the applicant is 18 years of age and older and a citizen of the United States. And so it just seems to me that that's a pretty significant switch in burden. And if that's not the case, then we should rewrite that sentence. The other thing that I'm a little concerned about in regards to the language that Mr. Mansky held up in regards to the form, but I think there's a pretty big difference between signing something that says I am not a felon, I am a citizen, versus the exact opposite. I mean, I would imagine a person would have a lot of trouble signing something that says I am a felon, I am not a citizen, and it seems like that is the big gap, and that's where I think the problem is going to come in, I think the opt-in is a significant problem, or the opt-out is a significant problem.
Mr. Mansky, you appear to want to answer.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative Broad, again, when this form gets redesigned, again, it will have the same oath on it that we currently have on the voter registration card, where it does say that by signing this, I am attesting that I'm not a felon, I'm not under guardianship, I'm not legally incompetent, etc. And if you want to take a look at the list of documents that the Department of Public Safety currently requires you to provide them in order to get a Minnesota driver's license or a state ID card, unlike when I got my first driver's license, where I basically just showed up and they took my picture and they gave me a driver test and I walked out of there with a license, now, for all intents and purposes, you either have to provide a passport or a birth certificate. And from that, we gain two things. Number one, we know how old you are, and we know what country you were born in. And if you have seen some of the newer driver's licenses, and if you happen to know anyone who was not born in the United States and is not a U.S. citizen, it does actually have a little indicator on the driver's license that says status check or something like that. So the Department of Public Safety does, in fact, know who is and is not a U.S. citizen, and that will be one of the filters that we will use, or that the Secretary of State will use, to get data to us. At our level, we will never get a record transferred to us that they have not filtered through these four screens, being the age, citizenship, and so on.
Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Mansky, the status check is not law. Mm-hmm. It's not in our law. So if the administration changes, that could go away. So there's no guarantee on that unless it gets put into law. So maybe that's an argument, Mr. Chairman, to add the status check actually as law onto this bill. Maybe that's something we could do a little bit further down the road. If we're going to use that as a stopgap, if we're going to say, oh, well, that information is there, we ought to, by law, ensure that it's there.
Mm-hmm. Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a chance for me to introduce to the committee a very interesting prop, courtesy of Representative Winkler, or actually his wife, Jenny, and I'll pass it around. This is just an example for those who haven't seen it, or maybe for those who have before. He was kind enough to bring it in. This is an example of what happens on his wife's driver's license. She is not a U.S. citizen. She is a permanent resident, and that's an example of what we have right now. Notwithstanding what Representative Ruff said about whether it's in statute, that's what's going on right now.
All right. Representative Kalin has been waiting patiently to make a small statement.
I will forego the statement that I wasn't even planning, Mr. Chair, and will instead make a question, direct a question to the Secretary of State, Mr. Ritchie. Two questions. One, I guess, actually, I will answer my own question, so I will make it a statement, Mr. Chair, and that is that I am inferring from the fact that you are bringing this bill forward that you are willing to take on the burden, considering that I believe that you've had a significant hand, your office, in writing this statute. So I think it's very clear that you're willing to take on the burden of the unfunded mandate that our local folks are taking on here. But if you could direct your attention to 1.14 in the amendment, the Secretary of State shall determine whether the applicant is a citizen of the United States. Can you just share with me and the committee and the public the mechanism, the mechanics of that check?
Mr. Secretary. Mr. Chairman, Representative Galen, the Department of Public Safety at the moment of gathering the driver's license application requires the provision of a primary and a secondary document. I believe you have the list there handed out, which requires both proof of age and citizenship status. They gather it right now for other purposes. They also gather information, selective service, that kind of thing. But then they would transmit to us the names of those people where citizenship was determined. Age, you know, is a kind of a standard, you know, date of birth, that kind of thing. And only those who said yes, I want, you know, they, those who did not choose to opt out. So that information would come from DPS, from the gathering of citizenship data as a primary and secondary document at the moment of the application for, you know, a new or duplicate or some other form of driver's license.
Representative Kamen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I may need a moment. I may want to revisit my question if there's more discussion.
All right.
Just to read through. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kalin, I just want to say one other thing about my willingness. We are very dedicated to things that will reduce the cost of government and make life simpler for townships, cities, and counties. And that's one of the kind of objectives of our office. And when the townships, cities, and counties come to us with very concrete proposals that can make the system more secure, less expensive, and easier for them to administer, we are strongly in favor of looking at those ideas.
Thank you.
Any Representative Walshanger?
Well, Chair members, I'd like to compliment you on this bill. I think this is one of the best bills I've seen to date. I've been a little frustrated with some of the others. They aren't worded very well, and not only is this one easy to read, which I appreciate, but it makes sense. And the fact that it's going to improve efficiencies and save money, I mean, I'm all for it. So thank you.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Simon, can you tell me what the position is of the Department of Public Safety on this piece of legislation? Representative Nelson and I were trying to figure out.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, I'll defer to the Secretary, who I know is meant for. We have Ms. Fraser here. Maybe
all right.
You can introduce herself.
Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, my name is Beth Fraser. I'm the Director of Governmental Affairs for the Secretary of State's office. We have been in discussions with the Department of Public Safety. My understanding is that they do not have a position on the bill. They just want to be sure that if it is passed, they get the resources to do what they need to do. And we have structured the bill in a way so that most of the burden is on us and that they have to do as little as possible. Also wanted
Ms.
to...
Ms. Fraser, is there a fiscal note that we're anticipating then for this? Is that...
Mr.
Public
Chair,
safety
yes.
is coming forward with a... Well, we don't have a fiscal note yet. One has been requested on this bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
All right.
Mr. Chair?
Ms. Fraser.
May I also clarify one of the answers to, I think, a question that Representative Broad asked about citizenship and how we'll determine that. New applicants have to provide a primary or secondary document. People renewing their driver's license do not. And so what we will do, how we will determine it, is we will add a question or move the question up about citizenship to the required part of the driver's license application. And so then applicants will be answering that question. They will be swearing that all of the information on the form is accurate. We will then send them the postcard, which will, again, indicate that they have to be a citizen in order to vote. And when they go to vote, they will sign the roster, which has the same oath that's on the voter registration card. Lying on both the Department of Public Safety's form and on the roster are both felonies. So we would use that data collected from that question to then filter out people who are not citizens.
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, so if I hear you correctly, didn't we say that this was going to go to finance? And
Representative Anderson, that is correct.
Considering the ramifications that this will have for the Public Safety Department, do you think that we perhaps should send it there instead? I'm just thinking there's some training component to it.
this.
No, to public safety, excuse
well,
me.
It has to go to finance first in order to go down to the division of representatives.
Okay, so, okay. I'm still trying to figure this out. So.
I'm still hoping.
Bounce that to there and then come back down.
Mr. Mansky had brought forward that this is a wash when all is said and done. I know Mr. Mansky is nodding back there. No.
Mr. Representative, nothing. We're doing this now on a weekly basis. We're talking about electronically transmitting it on a daily basis. We're talking about gathering a little more information. We've been going back and forth about things that they've been doing for us, you know, basically for free, and so they're trying to change the policy. But this is not a very expensive item for the Department of Public Safety. It's not a very expensive item for the judiciary. The only major cost is the first round of reprogramming at our department. And then after that, I think it's $15,000 a year for the U.S. Postal Service matching service that we're talking about, and some ongoing electronic data transfer that'll happen. So there'll be quite a significant savings overall.
And Representative Anderson, to your point, when a bill is referred to finance, it has to go to finance to then be re-referred to the division. And I assume this would end up in Representative Kahn's division.
It looks like, Mr. Chairman, from the appropriation, it looks like it could looked at by three divisions.
Well, three divisions, which makes it a rather cumbersome process, but that's the process that's before us. I have a chart in my office I can give you on this.
I think I call it leave no bill behind.
And I do pass it out free of cost, so just come on up and get it, and you can plot the path.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Anderson.
Just one more thing. You know, I'm not a member of the Public Safety Committee, but as I was looking through this, some concerns that I have that you might want to consider. I asked Mr. Gehring a question. I kind of put him on the spot. I asked if driver's licenses were forwardable and or non-forwardable when you get your driver's license in the mail. He wasn't sure, but he assumed because it's a legal document that it would be forwardable. And I know that in this language that you have in the bill that you talk about, you're sending the cards out and making sure that those are not non-forwardable, and you know, we maybe need to consider having some safeguards in place for that. And also, too, when you go to the voting to the polls on election day and you register to vote, you have to provide, you know, proof that you live where you live. Either somebody vouches for you or you have your utility bills and things like that. Well, when you actually look at the documents that are required to get your driver's license, there is nothing that I could read, maybe I missed it, that requires you to prove you live where you say you live. And maybe those are some things that we need to add into this component just to make sure that we can prevent voter fraud.
Ms. Frazier.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, the representative from the Department of Public Safety has indicated that driver's licenses are not forwardable, and so mailing the driver's license to the applicant does verify that they live where they have put on their driver's license.
All right. Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Frazier, thank you. You actually answered my question most directly about the citizenship, and I think that the putting an affirmative question requiring an affirmative statement of citizenship on the driver's license application is a very good move, and I will, if you need another advocate to press for it, I'd be happy to be one of those advocates.
All right. Any further discussion? Seeing no further, any Representative Olson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I first have a couple questions for counsel.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is, I think, indirectly been clarified, but I want to make it very clear. Under Minnesota law currently, voters, non-eligible voters, can get a driver's license. Is that correct?
Mr. Gehring?
Mr. Chair, I believe so.
Yeah. And the second question is driver's license, the address used on a driver's license, is that always the place of voting for that person?
Mr. Gehring.
Is there any certainty about that always being the place that they're going to vote, represent the jurisdiction of the place they're going to vote?
Mr. Chair, I guess I might have to defer to somebody who knows a bit more about driver's licenses. But I can imagine situations where the address on your driver's license might not be updated if you move, and so therefore that address wouldn't be where you're required to vote.
Right.
Representative Olson, I think the Secretary wants to respond to that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Olson, there are law enforcement officials who simply have post office boxes. There are other indications on driver's licenses. And it's one of the reasons that we are going to be sending out non-forwardable letters to ask, is this the address that you want to be voting? In other words, to make sure that they are able to respond. Increasingly, there are people with basically non-physical addresses on their driver's licenses for security or battered women, that kind of thing. And so we want to have a system so they can say back to us, no, here's the address where I live and this is where I want to vote.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Secretary. That's one of my questions. I had understood that this would save money. Mm-hmm. And the current system was described to me as the presumption being by the voter on the driver's license that I'm going to check this box because this is the place I'm going to vote. And that saves that exchange that you've just described. And now I hear that everybody's going to be presumed as wanting to register to vote unless they check the box, which is easy to, I'm not going to worry about voting, so they don't check the box. They don't read it right or read it fast. And now the state has to send out a card to confirm all this. And it seems to me that's creating more work, not less. Not only that, on the amendment, in the paragraph B, I mean, in some ways you could say you are now required to do a background check. So that's a lot more work.
Mr. Secretary, you want to respond to that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bolton. Right now, the counties are sending out cards, double-checking people's addresses. Our job is to make sure we're secure and make sure that we have them proper. We under this system, of course, if somebody's just changing their address, which is very common, it's simply changing the system, then we make sure that's proper. Overall, this is going to have a very large savings, and one of the good things about making the mailing is that we're allowed to update the list so that we keep very current on the addresses, which is a benefit to election judges. It's also a benefit to candidates, of course. It's also a benefit to all voters because we're able to move through the line faster on election day because the actual roster is up to date with the most current address.
Ms. Frazier.
Mr. Chair, if I could add to that, Representative Olson, you have to put down a residential address in order to be registered to vote. We're not going to register you to vote at your local post office. So if you have a P.O. box, you would not be automatically registered to vote. Those folks would need to register in the regular way. So I think that, you know, there are people who have a cabin and have a home and their driver's license will reflect one and not the other. There are students who, you know, live at home but vote at their college. But I think those are the few people for whom, in which this would really be a problem. I think that the cost savings overall would far outweigh the few people who have one address on their driver's license and have established a residence elsewhere where they choose to vote.
Representative Olson, we're past our time, so.
Well, speaking of your pardon, Mr. Chair, but I have not heard my questions really answered, my concerns really responded to, because we have a law where, under Minnesota law, non-eligible voters can get a driver's license. It doesn't necessarily have to do only with a P.O. box. As you noted, cabin owners, college students, that's very common. And it's not about just a few people. That's a lot of voters across the state. That's a lot of voters. And in most cases with college students, in many cases, they're voting elsewhere. And there's actually concerns there of voting, trying to vote in both places. And this arguably would create a greater likelihood of being able to do that because of the potential errors that the response from the state, they're already registered where they are with their driver's license, and the response with the state comes out. And if I, as a voter, don't really want to, let's say I, as a voter, want to vote in two places. You send that response out, and I just disregard it. And then I go vote at the college, and I go home and vote. Isn't that a potential area of fraud?
Mr. Secretary, you want to talk about Mr. potential Chairman, legal problems with that?
Well, it happens about once every cycle, and the young person and somebody who vouched for them are charged and convicted of felonies. And so it does happen, and it's a felony, and it's on your record the rest of your life. And Mr. Mansky, I know, has recently prosecuted two young people or county. Would you like to speak to how often and also the long-term implications for those young people?
Mr. Mansky, if you want to come up quickly, but we are running out of time.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Olson, if you were to vote twice in an election, we will catch up with it ultimately because, remember, all these documents, whether it's this or the file transfer, go into the same voter registration system. And every time you vote, we post your record as having voted. When we encounter the second one, then we send that off to the county attorney. And as the Secretary of State noted, that our county attorney did, in fact, prosecute a college student recently and who was convicted of voting both at the college and at his home in greater Minnesota. And more than that, he also convicted his friend who was the voucher. So the voter was convicted of vote fraud. His friend was convicted of perjury for filling out that yellow card that we were talking about yesterday. And the consequence is they're not going to go to jail for this, but every time they fill out a job application and every time they apply for an apartment lease, that thing's going to pop up when someone does the criminal background check for the rest of their lives.
Representative Olson, briefly.
Mr. Chair, with all due respect, Mr. Secretary and Mr. Mansky, I fully understand the consequences. I appreciate your response in that regard, but it does not respond to my concern that this system creates a greater likelihood and a greater capacity for a person to do that, despite the consequences.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of motivation to be able to do this. And this system, to me, creates a hole and a greater likelihood and a greater capacity for voters to be able to vote in two places and the system not be able to catch it. Because you're basically creating an avenue for them to be registered in two places with two different addresses. And you want to know how many Mark Olsons there are in my own district? I'd love this bill. I'll get the vote many times, maybe. Just kidding, of course.
Representative Broad, one more question, then we're going to move on the motion.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'm looking at the sheet, Mr. Mansky, and all this is in small type. I mean, so my concern is really that we're going to inadvertently create felons in the state of Minnesota because it's very small type. You know, and the understanding of what I might be signing or being opted into, you know, I will have resided in Minnesota 20 days immediately preceding the election day. Well, the driver's licenses are good for, what, 7 years? So how do you do that? I mean, it seems like you're asking them to sign something that just cannot be stated, and I'm concerned that you're creating felons.
Mr. Mansky, to the small font size felon.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Broad, I am totally in agreement with you. I hate this form. Just loathe it. And if nothing else comes out of this process and we get a better form out of this that you can actually read if you're a human being, that would be a huge improvement.
And I believe that discussion is for another committee. The motion before us is Representative Simons that House File 1546 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred to the Finance Committee. All those
roll
in favor
call.
Signify by saying aye.
Mr. Chair.
All those in favor signify by
roll call.
Roll call has been requested. The clerk will take the roll. The chair votes aye.
Representative Anderson?
No.
Representative Broad?
No.
Representative Emmer?
No.
Representative Hilke?
Aye.
Representative Powell? Representative Hahn?
Aye.
Representative Kena?
Aye.
Representative Morgan?
Aye.
Representative Nelson?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
No.
Representative Peterson?
No.
Representative Hoppe?
Aye.
Representative Simon?
Aye.
Representative Winter?
Aye.
Representative Goldschlager?
Enthusiastic.
Does that count for two, Mr. Chair?
There being 10 ayes and 5 nays, the motion prevails and the bill is on its way to finance. And with that, members, meeting is adjourned.